24. Next to a person's relationship to Jesus Christ, the act of faith that goes into trusting Christ as Savior, the next most important decision in life is the choosing of a mate, the selection of a marriage partner. It is not the will of God that everyone be married, but it is the rule, and to not be married is the exception. And God does work in some special ways when He gives the gift of celibacy. We studied that in 1 Corinthians 7. But to most, God grants the gift of marriage. And the decision to select one's marriage partner is, and I say this without any fear of contradiction, next to your personal trust in Christ is the next most important decision. It therefore should not be a decision into which you casually move. It should not be a decision that you should make under social pressure. It should be a decision that you make against the background of the greatest amount of information and the best kind of information. In Genesis 24, in one of the closing episodes in the life of Abraham, we find the subject introduced to us under the action of Abraham seeking a bride for his son Isaac. Now we have to note that in this chapter, that what is used here or what is found is a cultural distinctive. We do not follow all of the cultural patterns that we see in this 24th chapter. In our culture, it is not the father who sends out one of his servants to find a bride for his son or a groom for his daughter. In most cases, it is the case of a young man being the pursuer and seeking the hand of marriage and then asking the father, or maybe not even asking, the hand of his future bride's, asking his father that of the bride for him in marriage. So we do have to note that there are some cultural differences in this chapter, but out of this chapter can be seen some very important principles on selecting a mate. Now, there are, you'll notice, 67 verses. I don't know that there's a longer chapter in Genesis than this. I am not going to treat it verse by verse. I think I can very briefly, though, show you the three scenes that are involved and give us background for the principles that will come out of this chapter. The opening scene is in verses 1 through 9. Now Abraham was old, advanced in age, and the Lord had blessed Abraham in every way. His wife has died. He has buried her. His son Isaac is wifeless and is 40 years of age. Abraham calls his servant in, who is Eliezer, the oldest of his household, who had charge of all that he owned. Please place under your hand under my thigh. This was a means of sealing a contract or sealing a covenant. This man Eliezer was loyal. If you want to study in loyalty, study Eliezer. He would have been next in line for the inheritance if Isaac did not marry and have children. Eliezer was the one that Abraham had previously thought would have been the successor, but not according to the will of God. But yet Eliezer shows tremendous loyalty in pursuing this responsibility, down to the fine details. It's a magnificent study in loyalty. He says, I will make you swear by the Lord, the God of heaven, the God of earth, that you shall not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites, among whom I live. This was clearly prohibited. Passages later on in the plan of God for Israel, in Ezra, Deuteronomy, 1 Kings, This, of course, is a spiritual issue. It's not because there is not to be any marriage to the Canaanites because of a racial difference, but rather because of a religious difference. That is the principle of marriage to an unbeliever. Abraham did not want that. Nor did he want Isaac to go to the land where the servant would go to pursue his bride, because he wanted Isaac to stay and be in close proximity to the promised land. You'll notice that in verse 4. You shall go to my country, which is in Nahor, to my relatives to take a wife for my son Isaac. The servant said, suppose the woman will not be willing to follow me to this land. Should I take your son back to the land where you came, from where you came? Abraham said to him, beware lest you take my son back there. Don't do it. The God of heaven, who took me from my father's house and from the land of my birth, who spoke to me and swore to me, saying, to your descendants I will give this land. Isaac is descended. He wanted Isaac to take the land and not be led away, and did not want marriage to become the occasion from taking him what was God's ordered will for him. He will send his angel before you, and you will take a wife for my son from there. But if the woman is not willing to follow you, then you will be free from this my oath, only do not take my son back there. So the servant placed his hand under the thigh of Abraham his master and swore to him concerning the matter. That's the first scene. The second scene is the trip of Eliezer to Nahor, near Haran. This was a trip of about 450 miles, which would have taken him about a month. But that is passed over rather quickly. And we find next Eliezer in that area, and he's faced with the next issue. How will he know who would be the bride for Isaac? We find the first thing that he does is pray. Verse 12. O Lord, the God of my master Abraham, please grant me success today, showing loving kindness to my master Abraham. Then he sets up this plan and offers this sign. Now, he's not asking for anything arbitrary or spectacular, but the test is going to bring to light the qualities that God's looking for, and therefore that would be best for the bride, or that would be best for Isaac. May it be that the girl to whom I say, please let down your jar so that I may drink, and who answers, drink, and I will water your camels also, may she be the one whom thou hast appointed for thy servant Isaac, and by this I shall know that thou hast shown loving kindness to my master. The rest of the episode is the vivid description of that taking place. Before he had finished speaking, behold, Rebekah, who was born to Bethuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor. This takes us all the way back to the closing verses of chapter 23, which is going to underscore one of these principles, the providential hand of God, the sovereign hand of God, arranging the wife to be brought to Isaac. Isaac is not even there, and God is working to bring Rebekah to it. And she says, the girl was very beautiful, a virgin. No man had had relations with her. And she went down to the spring and filled her jar and came up. Well, of course, she's the one that carries out this act of hospitality. She quickly emptied her jar into the trough. She gave water to the camels. She went back selflessly and goes through this task of giving water to Eliezer and to the camels. And then he gives her look at the gifts that he provides. Then it came about, when the camels had finished drinking, that the man took a gold ring, weighing half a shekel, and two bracelets for her wrist, weighing 10 shekels in gold. She was excited. And the man then bowed low and worshipped the Lord and said, blessed be the Lord, the God of my master Abraham, who has not forsaken his loving kindness and his truth toward my master. The Lord has guided me in the way to the house of my master's brothers. And the girl ran, told her mother's household about these things. And then this brings up the third scene. And in this third scene, Eliezer comes into the home. He meets her brother Laban and her father Bethuel. And he goes over the whole account, how his master had sent him, how he had prayed that the one who would come out and would offer water and then offer to give drink to his camels as well, that this would be the one that God would have sent to be the wife of his master's son. And so he goes through all of this. And then as a result of that, Laban and Bethuel respond and say in verse 50, the matter comes from the Lord, so we cannot speak to you, bad or good. That is, we can do nothing one way or the other. This is obviously God working here. And so they allow her to go, but she has to make that decision herself. And in verse 57, it says, they said, we will call the girl and consult her wishes. Then they called Rebekah and said to her, will you go with this man? And she said, I will go. And they blessed Rebekah and said to her, may you, our sister, become thousands of 10,000s, and may your descendants possess the gate of those who hate them. Well, and that is a prophecy of the seed that's going to go down through Isaac and Rebekah to Jacob and down the line. Now, Isaac, verse 62, had come from going to Be'er Lahai-Roi, for he was living in the Negev. He went out to meditate in the field toward evening. And he lifted up his eyes, and he looked, and behold, camels were coming. And Rebekah lifted up her eyes, and when she saw Isaac, she dismounted from the camel. And I'm glad for that translation that's different there than in the King James. She lighted from the lighted the camel. That is some who think that that's the first reference of smoking, but it has nothing to do with that whatsoever. She did not light off her camel. She dismounted from the camel. So we're gratified for that change in the American Standard Version. She said to the servant, who is that man walking in the field to meet us? And the servant said, she is my master. He is my master. And then she took her veil and covered herself. And the servant told Isaac all the things that he had done. Then Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent. And he took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. Thus Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. Now there in that long chapter are the details of God providing a wife for Isaac. Now, you might think, well, that would be a nice way to handle it. Wouldn't that take some pressure off? If Dad could just get to work for me and just bring her in. But then somebody else would say, no. I don't want my dad going around and standing at his halls at school or standing after school and watch them come out. No, not that one. Or even saying, you bring them home, dear, and just let me check them out, and he stands over this checklist. Some would say, I don't know if I would like that cultural distinctive or not. Well, I guess we're just products of our time, and we all have an inclination to the manner in which we personally selected our wife, or at least the precedent that's been set for us. But in this, I find 8 universal principles on the selection of a mate. They transcend culture. True, there are some cultural differences, but these are 8 principles that transcend any culture and are necessary for you in the selection of a bride or a groom, as the case may be. Principle number 1. First principle, and I come back to the parents. Parental responsibility. So I'm going to talk to the parents for a minute. For all of you single folk, you relax for just a second or two until I get to you on the second one. But the first principle is parental responsibility. Who took the initiative? Abraham took the initiative. Of course, that was custom. But yet there is a universal principle. Though Isaac appears rather passive, though I may say this about Isaac, Isaac seems to be a very passive person. And maybe he had not taken any initiative himself. That might be possible. But we must understand the cultural situation, but recognize the universal principle that parental responsibility is the first principle in the selection of a mate. And by parental responsibility, I mean 3 things. 1, loving concern for the future partner of your son or daughter. Parents, listen well now. Loving concern for the future partner of your son or daughter. And I may be quick to say this to you single people. God uses parents in choosing your life's partner. You write that down, you remember that. God uses parents in choosing our life's partner. And the more we get away from that principle, the greater danger we have of missing the mark. Loving concern for the future partner of your son or daughter. Abraham took preliminary necessary steps to see to it that Isaac would have a bride. What advanced measures can we mothers and fathers do? We will not follow through in exactly the same manner as he did with Eleazar, sending him off to another country. But what advanced measures can we take to show our loving concern for the future partner of our son or daughter? I want to suggest four things that we can do to show our loving concern as parents in this selective process. Number one is prayer. Prayer. That you are you praying for the future partner of your son or daughter, parents? Pray not only for them, but with them. I think they should hear you praying with them about their future partner. I think when you pray with them, you would want to pray about the parents of that future husband or wife. You would want to pray that that future husband and wife might be growing in spiritual insight. You would want to pray for their physical protection, their moral protection. Those are the kinds of things that you would want to pray about. It would be rewarding when that son or daughter meets the right one, and that has been the result of years of prayer. And that will be a living demonstration of the fruitfulness of prayer. Pray for them. That is the first way you can show loving concern for your son or daughter's marriage partner. The second way in which you may show this concern is teach them by precept and practice what marriage is and what love is. Teach them by precept and practice what marriage is and what love is. Here is where I think a father and a mother could do a tremendous thing in teaching them the needs of a wife or the needs of a husband before they're ever married. You can do a wealth of work in premarital counseling, mothers and fathers. I mean, you can help my task. You can help Archie's task immensely if you as a parent would teach them. I wonder why we as parents, I say we, why parents haven't in the past taken this responsibility more seriously. I don't mean just passing on to them some well-worn out cliches about think it over, be careful, I don't like that one, or this or that and the other. But I mean sitting down with them and pointing out to them the needs of a wife or a husband, how it's what it's going to take in meeting those needs. Go through these things with them by practice and by precept. A third way in which you may show this loving concern is teach them by practice and precept the ways of God in life. So you're not limiting yourself to just teaching them about marriage. When life is marriage and marriage is life for most, and so therefore you will want to teach them the importance of being spiritually alert to dangers which will threaten their family. Teach them to be alert to spiritual dangers that threaten the family right now. Proverbs 1:7 says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction." Proverbs 1:8-9, "Hear, O my son, your father's instruction, and do not forsake your mother's teaching. Indeed, they are a graceful wreath to your head and ornaments about your neck." Do you know what is more important than being given a new automobile on graduation? Do you know what's more important than being given a huge cash sum on graduation? It is having the wreath and the necklace of wisdom that's been imparted to you from your parents so that you will know how to work through the selection process. And as you date, as you look the field over, you will have such discernment and perception as to the spiritual dangers in this world and how you should look and for who, what person you should look for. That is a wreath of victory. That is a status symbol. I want to suggest three things that you may do, parents, to teach them how to know the ways of God in life and how to prepare them. Number one, you would want to teach them how to identify evil influences. I think maybe a good thing for you to teach them what Proverbs teaches us about the fool, so that they can avoid the fool. If you will teach your son or daughter what a fool is, or how a person may act like a fool, that can do a lot for sharpening their discernment. So teach them how to identify evil influences. Secondly, teach them how they must learn to resist evil influences, how to stand against evil. At a very early age, I'm talking about in grammar school, they need to begin to learn this principle, how to resist evil. And thirdly, they must learn how they must resist evil influences. Or secondly, I should have said why they must resist evil influences. And thirdly, learn how they may resist evil influences, like wrong friends, moral impurity, television, love of money. The fourth way in which you may teach your or show loving concern for your child's future partner, God will honor faith in this matter. Do you realize that Abraham's action was an extraordinary act of faith? He was believing God to provide a marriage partner in a place 450 miles away, and that there would be one who would respond. Of course, he says, if she be willing, and that this, that God would work to bring a partner to Isaac. That's faith. And not allowing him to compromise by marrying someone who lived closer to him. That's faith. Parents, it's important that you exercise your faith in this matter. No need to fret. You could really get yourself into a state of extreme anxiety. I realize that in our world, as far as male selection and female selection, the pickings can get mighty slim. And apostasy and immorality have affected a great percentage of young people. That makes it difficult when you try to rear your child in this world to prepare them for that right marriage partner. You put that in the hands of the Lord and do these things that have already been pointed out. I want to give you as an illustration, just from this chapter, before we leave this first area, notice what Eliezer did in his prayer. That while he was still praying, God was working to send Rebekah out there in answer to that prayer. That ought to be encouragement to realize that in your very prayers that God is working at that time. And even before you finish praying, that God is working somewhere else, unbeknownst to you, protecting and preparing and bringing that person along. What is the second thing that parental responsibility would take into account besides loving concern? Secondly, definite convictions about character qualities. Definite convictions about character qualities. In other words, what pleases God? What to look for? You need to know, parents, so that you can teach your children. You need to have definite convictions about character qualities, not preferences. Preference, maybe yes, maybe no. A conviction is a basic scriptural principle which we purpose to follow whatever the cost, and that may mean eliminating some what might seem some good prospects along the way. And parents, you will eliminate those prospects for your children by seeing through things. Parents have wisdom that the child should be a beneficiary of. They have hindsight. They can see things. They have things in an objective view that often the young person does not. That is why you must allow on the wisdom, base a lot on the wisdom of your parents. All right, let me suggest and principles involved in these definite convictions that you must have, parents. There must be parents. I'll go through these quickly because for most of you, that's familiar territory. Do you know what the fruits of the Spirit are, parents? Can you recognize the fruit of the Spirit in somebody else? Can you go to Bible characters, secondly? Can you go to Bible characters and see how the fruit of the Spirit is evidenced in their life to show that to your children so that your children can begin to form some good examples and models for life, that they can see it in a particular person? Help them to identify the fruit of the Spirit in people. Don't just teach these things abstractly, but show them in concrete ways. I think the little character sketchbook that's put out by the Basic Youth Conflicts can be of help to you here in teaching these qualities. Thirdly, expose your children and yourself, of course, to strong Christians. Expose your children to strong Christians, having them in your home. That is one of the great values of good interchurch relationships. You are at a disadvantage if you live your life, as an island unto yourself. If you have children and you go for months and never have other Christian families in your home to share the meal with you and time with you, you are eliminating one of the great teaching tools for your children. Now, why you don't do that, you'll have to answer that and work that out. But I'll tell you again, you are eliminating from your teaching program a great amount of leverage in teaching your children. I wouldn't give anything for the times we have had different ones in this church, and that our children have been able to see what God is doing in their life. You see, it's a reinforcer. It reinforces the things that we have been teaching, and then they see it in another life. That's invaluable. I wouldn't take anything for the single people we've had in our homes and eating at our table. And they've been a ministry to our children probably more than they realize. And that they have seen God working in that life, and they have seen a young person single in this world system living for the Lord and resisting the pressures. And so it gives them a good model. They know it can be done. They see it in somebody else. So parents, expose your children to strong Christians. Four, scripture memorization. We emphasize that here. You know about that. Five, attention and concentration, the messages in church. Teach your children to concentrate, to attend the services in the church. Why? To teach them to listen and to grow as a result of this teaching. I'm not saying that they need to sit there and understand everything. But one of the best ways you can prepare your children to develop discernment and teach them qualities to look for is to have them attend services and listen to what's being said. They will learn, among other things, poise, how to handle themselves in difficult situations. And parents who give in and are intimidated by their children because their children might squirm a little bit or want to do something else, and so they get intimidated and let them watch TV. They need to learn to develop poise in an academic situation where they are going to be given something so that they can begin to pick up a radar system, develop a radar system, and develop in these areas. Define and illustrate Christ-like qualities for your children. Define and illustrate Christ-like qualities. Could somebody turn the heat down? It's killing me up here. I don't know what's going on with it, but... It may be me. I'm moving around, but I feel like I'm in a furnace here. Thank you. Just turn them off, and maybe it'll cool down a little bit. All right. Define and illustrate Christ-like qualities. And here is where you are wont to set before your children, parents, contrasting things like qualities, and on the one hand, and on the other, weaknesses, sinful traits, good traits, bad traits. For instance, the difference between truthfulness and deception, the difference between self-control and self-gratification, the difference between contentment and covetousness, generosity and stinginess, endurance and giving up, diligence and slothfulness. Now take this matter of diligence. Take Proverbs 6 and study the ant. Go to the ant, thou sluggard. Consider ways. You can teach determination as a Christ-like quality from that story about the ant. You might want to look up and find something about the ant. What can be? Now, we have a tape that we've gone through, Proverbs 6, if you need to get background. But take that and maybe have a family project on observing the ant. Teach something, a quality, a Christ-like quality. And when you teach this principle of determination, this is the very, I'm going to take this as a principle. I'm teaching this Thursday morning to the fellows over here at Lakeshore High School. Take this matter of determination, and I'm going to relate to some biblical illustrations and some qualities involved. For instance, as you teach your children the quality of determination and how to recognize it in other people at the same time, give them a definition of it. Do they know what it is? Like, it's learning to give what energy is necessary to complete a goal. Might be something little, like making up a bed. You see, if they are learning it, then they will be in a better position to start seeing it in others and wanting that. Make them fall in love with these things so that they will want these things in somebody else. Some very simple questions you could teach them to ask when you have the study on determination would be like, does your home contain projects which you've started, not yet finished? That would be an index on this matter of determination. Have you ever quit a job or a sports event because you thought you wouldn't succeed? Ask them these questions. Go into the concept, determination. You're not only teaching them and yourself, but you're preparing them for selection in the future and looking for these qualities. Like the third thing that you would do as a parent, we're still talking about parental responsibility. Here it is. Supervision. Now, young people, you can phase back in because we're picking you up now. Supervision of, you're not going to like this one, but it's important. And it runs counter to our culture. You ready for it? Goes back to other principles, all right? I've gotten the go-ahead. Supervision of the date life of your son or daughter. Supervision of the date life of your son or daughter. All right, very quickly. I know I'm loading you up with a lot, but I'm going to do it anyway. Here we go. 9 principles in regulating the date life of your son and daughter. If it's too late, grandchildren next. Start with your children to teach their grandchildren. Supervision of the date life of your son or daughter. All right, 9 principles. First of all, the relationship of the mother and the father to the child establishes a precedent. Let me restate that. The relationship of the mother and father establishes a precedent. I'm talking about the relationship the mother and father have. A good relationship is a good example. That will do an immeasurable amount of work for you when it comes to the dating process. You do not have to be in fear, then, of them wanting to break out of the house and escape. And just, for girls concerned, just date anything that comes along in pants. But she'd be discerning. And she would be careful. She sees what a good relationship her mother and dad has. She wants that. He wants that. So they're going to be very particular. Secondly, establish an atmosphere of love and obedience to God's ways. And here's what I'm emphasizing. A little bit of overlap, but I want to add this different detail. I'm talking about establishing an atmosphere of a happy home life. And this will provide them with the necessary security. Make this matter of dating a positive issue. Make a positive approach to dating and marriage. I think a lot of parents have made some of their own problems in this by just immediately laying on their son or daughter a lot of negatives in dating. You can't go this, you can't double date, you can't do that, you can't go here, you don't want you to date so-and-so. And it's just become an entire negative thing. Let it become a positive thing that your home life provides security. And it's an example, as I've already said, of the first principle. And that if the emphasis is on dating and its restrictions, rather than on positive reinforcements to what you've been teaching about life and love and good relationships, that it may backfire on you. I've seen it backfire when parents are just solely negative on this thing of dating. And you got to be in at 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock, and you can't do this. Now, I'm not saying there aren't rules necessary, but if you are purely negative, it's going to backfire. You say, what did we do? We tried to follow the Word of God. Maybe part of it, but you didn't give them the whole picture. Positive reinforcement. Create an atmosphere that they enjoy. Thirdly, teach them satisfaction with present circumstances. Teach them satisfaction with present circumstances. They must learn to serve the Lord while single. If you find your son or daughter building their whole life around a relationship or dating in general, I mean, their whole mood swings are built around how they're getting along with opposite sex, you better get in on that. Because they can miss some wonderful years and some important lessons by sitting around moon out all the time. Now, I don't know that you can do anything to not puppy love in the head. I mean, that's going to happen. They're going to walk into English class one day. She's going to see him over there. And she's going to come home not going to eat. She's going to want to write notes. You're going to find a little love note in her pocketbook. And it's going to say, does so-and-so like me? Could you find out? And the phone's going to ring. You're going to say, who is it? Who is it? They're saying, just a friend. And they get a flushed look on their face. And they talk kind of real low. And they aren't real relaxed. Now, you're going to have some episodes like that. But I'll tell you what you need to do, though, is be alert as a parent to the fact, are they becoming dissatisfied? Do they think that satisfaction is just being with the opposite sex? You'll have to try to teach them some lessons about where satisfaction and contentment come from. Four, encourage them to concentrate on schoolwork. Encourage them to concentrate on schoolwork. That is a priority while in school. It's not an incidental. Now, if you had told me that at one time, I would have maybe not have taken it real seriously. But I thought maybe school was the place you had to go before you could get out to play ball. I mean, you just had to do that. Serve your time, get out and play ball. You've done your duty. And like I try to tell Eric, the things that to you are most important now will one day be the least important. And the things that are least important now will one day be most important. So get to work and get things in perspective now. No, sure, go and enjoy ball. Go and enjoy sports. But that, I mean, you'll be one out of a million if you ever make it to the New York Yankees or to the Atlanta Falcons. Listen, have your boyhood or girlhood idols, if you will, and so on, but keep it in perspective. And parents, keep our children keeping it in perspective by their schoolwork, and that will help eliminate some problems with dating. If they don't know what a priority is. Schoolwork. Five, encourage participation in beneficial projects, hobbies, after-school activities, things like music, sports. Find out where the interest of your children lies and pursue it. Help them, encourage them to pursue it. If it's collecting butterflies, Help them collect butterflies. Why? Because if they develop interest, they're going to have that much less time for preoccupation with dating when they don't need to be. Now, this is true more for the younger teens than the older teens. But these are the things that will, in the long run, be the most important. Developing these interests and discipline in this area, in this time in life. So encourage the participation in beneficial projects, hobbies, after-school activities, that kind of thing. Six, teach them the danger of the wrong man and wrong woman. Teach them the danger of the wrong man, wrong woman. Just look through Proverbs. Notice how much Solomon warns on that principle. Proverbs 2, 5, 7 devotes tremendous amount of material to the wrong woman. Watch out for her, because the girl might be the wrong man. Now, that's the place for sex education in the home. Show them the place of sex in life. Because you can do it in a context of authority and in a context of spirituality, which the world is not equipped to do. There's an article in this morning's paper that got my dander up a little bit. Grizzard wrote it, and about sex education. He was getting on the case of the folks up here in Cobb County. They don't want to have sex education in schools. Well, as I was reading it, I was responding to it mentally to some of the things. He makes some typical liberal mistakes. You'd think they would understand that after a while, that education never solves a problem that's moral in nature. See, his assumption is this. If you educate children about sex, then you will cut down on sex problems. You see, the assumption is that they don't even necessarily assume there's anything as immorality. The assumption is that the problem is only one of mental in nature. They just need more information. False assumption. That's why I made the conclusion. So we can't even grant his premise. The problem is a moral, spiritual problem. You're not, and I would have asked him this, if sex education in the public schools is such a great thing and is going to solve teenage pregnancies, then tell me, why are we having more problems with it than we've ever had before, and we've got more information disseminated on sex than we've ever had before? Explain that. Well, there are a lot of other things. I don't want to get too sidetracked here. But the place for you to do it, parents, is in the home. And I think educators say this too, and I want to be fair to the educators in the public schools. But in a sense, they find themselves backed into a wall, the corner, because parents don't do their job. And they try to do something, and I'm willing to give them, many of them, the benefit of the doubt here. They're trying to do something, but parents are just negligent. Parents, it comes back to us to provide that context. That will help in this dating regulation. Seven, encourage them to date the proper kind of person. Encourage them to date the proper kind of person. This goes back to teaching them about qualities. This should start before they ever start thinking about dating. It probably gets their views toward the opposite sex might tend to get a little less than objective about 13 and 14. So you'd better get them while they're fairly objective, while they're still interested in cats and dogs and more than there are the opposite sex. So teach them something about who you should and shouldn't, the kinds of people, who you should date and who you shouldn't. Number eight, establish the limits for dating practices. And give reasons, things like when, where, what time home, meet and talk with the person that they're going to date. Yes, I think they should have your approval. That is a beautiful protective device, is that the girl's father, he screens them. That's right. He screens them. I guarantee you one thing, is that I want to know who wants to date my daughter. I want to know what kind of character he is. And Miriam knows I want to know too. And I will want to know something about him. And there will be some rules. And parents, Fathers, you have this responsibility if you have a daughter. As son as well. Now, who they're dating? Don't go along. I don't know. Well, who's that girl you dated 2 months ago? I think it's your responsibility to find out, parents. 9. Help them to avoid serious relationships before they are prepared to handle them. Help them to avoid serious relationships before they are prepared to handle them. Parents, this is where you're going to have to really be discerning and firm. A serious relationship at an early age can create all kinds of complications because the emotional will be way ahead of the objectivity in the middle. And they will be insisting that they have a right to marriage at an early age, and they're so emotionally involved in that one another's lives, they spend so much time together, that they're almost driven to distraction. And what may be happening is they've spent so much time together, they're burning with passion. That's what's happening. They're burning with passion. And they're both in a wave of libido. And parents, you could possibly have prevented that by seeing it in early stages of an intense relationship developing. You've got to sort of, whoa, wait a minute, and explain why. Now let's go to the second principle, beyond parental responsibility. Secondly, personal responsibility to follow the guidance of God. Personal responsibility to follow the guidance of God. Now I'm speaking directly to you who are looking for a marriage partner, or may someday. You may not be interested now, but you may someday. Personal responsibility to follow the guidance of God. There are 6 things that you can do as a single person in preparing yourself for a future marriage partner. 1, I mentioned it with parents, but here it is for you. Pray for discernment to recognize God's hand, just like Eliezer did. What was Isaac out in the field meditating about in verse 63? Is he praying about this? He knew it was happening. Could have been. Are you praying about your future partner? Are you? Have you? Can you count the times on the fingers of one hand, the times you pray for your future marriage partner, if there is one for you? So pray for discernment to recognize God's hand. Ask for wisdom. We're told to in James 1. Any of you lack wisdom? Let him ask of God. He'll give it to you. That's insight based on doctrine that you've already learned. God will give you insight into life. 2, seek to go to the right places and meet the right people. Seek to go to the right places and meet the right people. Now here's where the danger of the wrong crowd and the wrong places comes in, and where you single people can do a lot for yourself or against yourself. Where do you go to meet people? I'll tell you one thing. If you think that you're going to meet the right person out here at a singles bar, who are you kidding? You're going to meet somebody else more than likely. Now, it may be possible for anybody who met their husband or wife in a singles bar. My apologies. But chances are, you're going to meet somebody else that's out on the prowl. And it might just very well be a couple of losers. And you don't know what you want. Might be only interested in the physical. And that's a very shallow basis for a relationship. So watch. Where are you going? What kind of friends do you develop? Let me tell you this. Understand the context of this statement. I realize that going off to a Christian school, the primary motivation is not going to find a husband or a wife. But I can't think of a much better place to find one. Now, in the past, there have been jokes about schools being match factories and Christian schools and young ladies going off to a Bible school to find a husband. You know what I say? So what? I'd lot rather them being off at a Bible school trying to find a husband or wife than in a singles bar with the wrong crowd. It doesn't have to be either or. One reason for that, in a Christian school, depending on the quality of the school, a screening process has taken place. And that, oh, I would say over 80, maybe around 80% or more, that they have gone through a crisis in their life on commitment, total commitment to the Lord. If it's a Bible school, they've wrestled with this, and they're there because they want to be totally committed to the Lord, and they're studying His Word. Now, they can still get the wrong person there, true. It's no panacea, no formula, but don't knock it. Don't knock it. There's nothing wrong if that's going to be one of the benefits of going there. You don't need to say, oh, now we can't think about that. You're just going there to study the Bible. Let's be practical. You're going there to study the Bible and expose yourself to other people who are Christians, and if they happen to be of the opposite sex, fine. I'm glad I went to Bible school. Well, let's go on. Seek to go to the right places and meet the right people. Single people? 3. Trust in the sovereign hand of God to bring the right one to you. Trust the sovereign hand of God to bring the right one to you. God's not limited to an active date life. Actually, Isaac was very passive. That's no license to be passive in the spiritual sense, but he was provided for. There's no need to worry. So what if he doesn't phone back and ask for a second date? Well, you're under no pressure. Who said you got to have him call back? So God's taking care. If he didn't call back, it's God's sovereign hand working. Probably you bet he didn't call you back. I mean, you may not even know what a slobby is. So don't worry about it. If he's for you, he will. Relax. And get all tied up in knots. Start thinking you've got to make phone calls. Say, I'm of the old school, where the fellow's the initiator. You know, that you don't call and ask for the dates. And he comes to the door and picks you up. He comes, you don't meet him halfway or, yes, I'll come by and pick you up to the fella from the girl. No. 4, seek wisdom. Seek the wisdom of those already happily married. Here's some of that inner church relationship matter, issue that's important. Seek the wisdom of those already happily married. Young people, you can do a lot for yourself by getting to know the adults in the church. Do you see a family that seems to be particularly a husband and wife, happily married? Why don't you get to know them? How did they meet? How did God work in their life? Why don't you let that be a catalyst to help you in your own date life and looking for the right person? 5, do not allow social pressures to force you into a premature marriage. You're up around 16, 17. I'd say in most cases that's premature marriage. Or at least, what Isaac was 40. What are you in such a hurry for? You're in better shape if you wait to 40 and get the right one and get married at 16 and get the wrong one. See, I keep getting these people come in for counsel. And I learned it the hard way. I had somebody come in for counsel about 15 years ago, and they were 19, both of them, and I assumed that this was their first marriage. I didn't ask if they'd been divorced. Well, I happened to ask them as they walked out the door. They'd both been married before. One had a child by a previous marriage. They were 19. They already lived one life. They were 19. They were just kids. They didn't know what they wanted. Probably didn't get good parental guidance at all. And so, don't be in a hurry. And don't allow social pressures to force you into marriage. So what if all your friends are getting married? Don't worry about advancement in age. Don't get married as a relief from loneliness. That won't solve a problem. Then you'll just be lonely with somebody else, and that's even worse. It's one thing to be lonely when you're by yourself, but it's the security of having a man around. You got to have a man around to keep the burglars away or something, to provide. Or, he might be my last chance. Because all the ones you can think of are off the list, and this might be the last one on the list. Or, well, I guess I'd better take what I can get, and this looks like the best, so I'm going to go ahead. Or sexual pressures. Sexual pressures. Now, that's a consideration. Sexual pressure is a consideration, 1 Corinthians 7. But that's not why you should get married. Or I can even drop in another one on you. I love him. Or I love her. Oh? Good. But that doesn't mean you ought to get married. You can love the wrong person. 6. Respect the authority of your parents in this matter. I've come back to parental responsibility, haven't I? Respect the authority of your parents in this matter. This is a primary means of guidance for you, and don't underestimate it. You may just mark this down. Opposition from your parents to a future marriage partner may mean one of two things. Either no or not yet. If they say no. But you listen. You listen. Take their wisdom. Talk to them about it. If you resist it, and this is always one of the questions that I ask when couples come in and want to get married. One of the first questions, what do your parents think about this? Have you met both your parents? By the way, I got a policy here. I've been looking for a chance to get it in. Here it is. Let's spread the word abroad. Now, this is just for this church. I have no control over the outside, but for this church, please. I wish I had said this years ago, but I've learned something. Don't set a wedding date until after you've gone through premarital counseling. I do not prefer for people to come to me and say, we're going to get married on this date. Will you marry us? Then I say, well, listen, I would like you to come by a few times and we talk. And then I get on in the series of discussions, and I find that they aren't ready. But they've already sent out invitations. She has already gotten her wedding gown. They've gotten the church booked. They got the mother-in-laws at a fever pitch. And here I am. And whether they fail or pass my counseling has nothing to do with it. Now, I can't do anything about the water already under the bridge. And I'm not saying I failed, but there have been some times when I really didn't like that pressure at all. And one time, after all this preparation, I had to tell them that I couldn't. Now, they'd already set up the date, and that's not easy. So I think I'm going to try to do myself a favor and you a favor. I see a lot of young faces. Now, I may have a part in your wedding, I may not. But let's spread this abroad. We will run this off, and we will get this out as the policy. Please, try not to set a wedding date until you have gone through the premarital counseling course. That's important. It saves you from a lot of pressure, and it'll save me from some embarrassing situations. Now, I've looked for weeks to get that in, and it came right here. All right.